But we definitely worked with those guys. And they were good men. And they were men of God.
In reading part of Laura Kaplan's book, she spoke of a piece of history when abortion was illegal and the service was functioning. A lot of people turned a blind eye to the service. Clergy, other doctors sent their patients to the service. Cops, you know, institutions that today we feel would be batting for the other team were actually helping and seeing that as a conscious decision.
Absolutely.
If today abortion were illegal again, how do you feel that a similar service would be seen in this political climate by individuals as well as the state?
Okay. That's a really important question. And I'm glad to answer it because I want to be sure that people understand that it will be way more dangerous now, way more dangerous. No doubt people will do it. It's important, too, that that your audience understand that abortion has been around as long as women have been not monkeys, you know, that human females have aborted or, when abortion was not available to them, committed infanticide in order to control the lives of their particular mother and child unit or the tribe or the clan or whatever. So abortion is, you know, an historical fact, unquestionably. Now, this is a far more dangerous climate. And this is a climate in which both individuals, even people who support abortion rights, will be extremely reticent, extremely reluctant, and possibly completely unwilling to do what needs to be done. So women will die in great numbers in the early months and years when they turn, you know, when they overturn Roe. Women are, in fact, in serious trouble now, having babies they cannot afford, babies they cannot give love to, babies they cannot raise, because even though it is legal, it is very difficult to get for thousands and thousands of women in the United States, and certainly many, many even here in Oregon, where finding what you need and being able to afford it to get an abortion, if you don't live in Portland, if you don't live in Bend or maybe Ashland and Eugene, okay, that's it, then you're in trouble, even though it's, quote, legal. And pretty soon, it's going to be against federal law to go across state lines. They're going to do that. They're doing it in some places already. So that, let's say, a 15-year-old lives in a state where it's illegal. If anybody helps her go to a state where it's legal, then they're committing a felony. Jody, it's going to be very dangerous. There's going to be a lot of dying. There's going to be a lot of grief. And it's going to take some amount of years before the populace comes back to the mindset that developed between World War II and the Roe decision, that little period of history that I'm using here for the sake of our conversation, where people recognize that abortion is a fact of life. You cannot not have it, especially if you don't have contraception that is 100% safe and 100% effective, which, of course, surprise, surprise, we don't have. It doesn't exist. If kids are not taught how to use contraceptives, if contraceptives are not made available to them, if even single people who are not married can't get them. You got to remember, we're talking about a time when it was still in the 60s in the United States, in many places, illegal for a pharmacist to sell a contraceptive to an unmarried woman. And to a man, but of course they, surprise, did sell to men under the counter, chuckle, 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 with the Playboy magazines.
I read something that just freaked me out recently about the Sanctity of Life Day. It's basically a pro-life holiday that George Bush has stirred up. And he made a speech that basically alluded to the fact that abortion was in line with terrorism. So that just kind of goes to show what level of paranoia and fear and repression that we're working with.
And I think that among those three, the third one, repression, is probably the one that's going to affect most of the people, because the folks who would in 1967 or 1971 have had the mindset that, let's say, I had or my parents had, will not be available to them because of the top-down imposition of the position of the pro-life movement, the so-called pro-life movement. And it will be very hard for people to, literally very hard for people to think that way. I believe that what we're going to need when it's illegal again at the federal level is the equivalent of an underground railroad. And fortunately, we have a model because of slavery and its attendant and post-emancipation child racism. There will need to be organizations of that nature to provide what the service provided as you quoted, an open secret. There will be no use of the open secret method in the United States for quite a while. It will be very dangerous. My slogan, if I had a bumper sticker of my own, is abortion is a motherhood issue. Abortion is one of the things that we must think about and talk about when we talk about motherhood. And motherhood is one of the things we must think about and talk about when we talk about abortion and think about abortion. There's no question. This is all one subject. The fact of our being mothers, in the case of those of us who were mothers, was very much a part of our creating an analysis of what abortion needs to be. Abortion should be available to any woman or girl who believes that is the right choice for her. It should be done in a loving and supportive atmosphere. It should be free, like all good health care, and it should be readily available across the land. That was what we thought. And it seems to me that being mothers was very much a part of our understanding of why that should be so. It's all part of the same fabric. The separation is artificial, damaging, dangerous, is one of the sources of all of our grief over this issue in the United States at present.
What you're saying reminds me of one thing that I thought was really interesting when I was reading Laura Kaplan's book, which was that it became an issue among some people in the service when there were women that were visibly pregnant becoming counselors.
That's right.
That was really interesting to me.
It was very interesting. It was one of our most interesting arguments. You know, we had arguments every step of the way when it was out in the open. And I mean that in the most positive way. We would argue. We would, you know, deeply impassioned arguments would be brought forward. In this particular case, I was one of the women who was pregnant on purpose while I was a Jane. And I was in favor of not being told that I couldn't do counseling and abortion and the clinical work while I was pregnant, because women should have babies when we want them and abortions when we need them. And this continuum that I was just going on about would be a sham, would be a lie if we had to hide it. And I think that the women who were on the other side of the argument at first, but who came over, weren't against it in the sense that they didn't believe they were part of the same fabric, but they were afraid of upsetting the women who came. An interesting commentary on my concerns about mothers being perceived appropriately as being responsible for the lives of their children, mothers being appropriately vested with that responsibility and the expectation in society that they will take care of business, is that now, in contemporary U.S. of A., mothers are being held responsible in grievously twisted ways around that, so that women can be put in jail for using drugs while they're pregnant. Women can be put in jail for, soon we'll come to the point where women can be put in jail for jaywalking while pregnant because they're endangering the life of the fetus. I say that facetiously because we are literally in a time when cases almost like that, women's diets, women's personal social habits are on the docket. They're brought to court and sent to jail if in their particular community they have in some way transgressed either against an actual law or a social moray around motherhood. because the fetus is now more important than the woman. So that it's not about mother right, but it is about holding mothers responsible, which is very different from mothers taking responsibility.
In October of 2002, the Bush administration issued regulations specifically making fetuses, but not pregnant women, eligible for health care coverage under the Children's Health Insurance Program. And there's a new law out called the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, mm-hmm. which is a lot of what you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. It seems that the house of cards is getting bigger and bigger and bigger and pointing in, you know, a direction that looks pretty much like we don't have a lot of time.
Well, we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
That's right. We don't have a lot of time. And I hope you're right that it's a house of cards, because then the more complicated it gets, the more baroque it gets, the more chance there is that it will fall down. But at the moment, it's definitely at the top of its game. Very powerful, very complicated, well wrought, quite successful, and it's enormously important for our team to recognize that, and to, when we educate ourselves, when we take action, when we move against that structure, we do it with the knowledge of this machine that you have just described, this house of cards that you're talking about, and not only out of our idealism. We need to be stone conscious of what we're up against.
Where do you see the power in combating this wave of repression? And what are some things that you have found to be inspiring or, that have given you hope?
I believe that the answer is always that we think more deeply, that we recognize always that everything is more complicated than it first appears to be. And so you have to investigate. You have to actually think deliberately and repeatedly about the questions that are asked of you as a citizen, as a person, as a woman in this world, in this country at this time. For instance, you say to yourself, okay, they say abortion is murder. What do I think about that? What do I actually think about that? What does that actually mean? In fact, and I'm not kidding when I say this, what is abortion? What is it really? What's going on? What's going on in the woman's life? What's going on in her body at that moment? These are the questions that we have to ask ourselves. And we don't ask them alone. We first ask them inside our heads. Maybe we write them down. Then we turn to our friends. We go to meetings. We hang out with our buddies and we say, what do you think? Here's what I think. What do you think about what I think? We have to keep talking to each other, preferably in larger and larger groups. We have to keep educating ourselves. We have to keep educating ourselves. And if we find ourselves in a situation where the people around us can only say no, or I won't, or that's no good, then we have to change our situations, which is very scary and definitely difficult, but absolutely required. In December, I was a guest at a big meeting at Planned Parenthood of all of the regional staff. And when I looked out at the room that I was going to talk to, there were about 80 people there. One of the things I noticed right away is that most of them were way younger than me. And that was a big thrill, because sometimes if you only pay attention to the canned and dangerous media, you think that no one under the age of 45 really has any desire to think about and act on any of these issues. But it's not true. Plus, like I mentioned, the March on Washington earlier, the range of people at that event was phenomenal. That was such a kick. When you talk about inspiration, you don't always, you think sometimes in spiritual ways. But actually, you can think about it, here I am with biology again, in physical ways. What is inspiration but breathing in? And when I saw all those people out there, it was like a constant orgasmic gasp. wow, you know, it was a thrill a minute, a thrill a minute. So that's how I get off.
Judith Arcana's most recent book, What If Your Mother?, is a collection of poems and monologues about abortion and related themes. It will be published by Chicory Blue Press this fall. Judith Arcana reads What If Your Mother?
Sometimes when you talk to them, in argument they say, what if your mother had an abortion? And then I say, she did, because it's true. Only that one wasn't me. It was somebody else. Nobody but my mother ever knew that baby. But they mean me, the people who say it. Mean, what if she aborted me? Like, that's hard to answer. They're so stupid, because what if she miscarried or gave me away? What if I drowned at the beach when I was 3? What if she loved someone else, not my dad? Then I wouldn't be here either. What if? What if? What's the point of asking this phony question? All you could ever answer is, then everything would be different, wouldn't it? One thing, sure. I wouldn't be standing here talking to some jerk who asked me that dumb question. I wouldn't be around to feel all angry at my mother, would I? I think you just have to tell these people, get real. That's not what it's all about.
That was Judith Arcana, interviewed by the Circle A Radio Collective in Portland, Oregon. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. And this announcement is for local listeners regarding the Tompkins County Marches for Peace this coming Saturday, March 17th. A coalition of local organizations, ad hoc committees, and individuals are working to mark the fourth year of the war in Iraq and calling for a countywide mobilization of protest. The themes of the event are the illegality of the war, honoring those who've died, war's consequences for our communities, the growing threat of war with Iran, upholding the rule of law, and grassroots impeachment. There will be over 12 marches from area neighborhoods, with contingents from all over the county, Trumansburg, Enfield, Danby, Lansing, Groton, Dryden, Ulysses, Caroline, and Newfield. These marches will all converge to the Commons in downtown Ithaca for a 3 p.m. rally. Some of the speakers at the rally will include U.S. Congressman Maurice Hinchey, Matt Rutke, an Iraq War veteran, Martha Robertson, a Tompkins County legislator, and Marty Lester, a former New York State assemblyman. For more information on the web, www.IthacaPeaceVigil.org, IthacaPeaceVigil.org, which has details of when and where to connect with other marchers.
Some set their hearts on a rocking chair, the better to sleep out the days. But I'm looking for a reason to kick and scream. I don't want to fade away. We think that the power is in our hands, 'cause we're holding the remote control. Pile up the lot, and what have you got? if you catch me falling gently into the night. Shine up my shoes, 'cause I can't get used to the dying of the light. Some set their hearts on a rocking chair, the better to sleep out the days. But I'm looking for a reason to kick and scream. I don't want to fade away. Fade away.
Week's reading of John Taylor Gatto's An Underground History of American Education, we left off with a description of the bizarre rituals forced upon immigrant workers at Henry Ford's auto plant, which were designed to make them, quote, real Americans. This was but one of the more grotesque episodes in a general climate in the early 20th century that was attempting to foist upon the population an official Americanism and enforce a cultural conformity to that image. We're going to resume with our reading in Chapter 11 of Gatto's treatise on the social control agenda behind compulsory education. John Taylor Gatto spent 3 decades as a teacher in New York City, and his experience led him to conclude that our educational system was creating the opposite effect from what most people expect that it seeks to accomplish, intellectual development. His work documents that the failure of our educational system to reach this goal is not an accident or an error, but rather the realization of the aims of its founders, whose goals were the maintaining of hierarchies of power and privilege in America. And Gatto writes, Francis Amasa Walker, president of MIT, first declared in 1891 what was soon to become an upper-class mantra. Anglo-Saxons were quietly committing, quote, racial suicide. The insult of competing with Latin, Slavic, and Celtic folkways seemingly discouraged reproduction among families of the old stock. After that bombshell, an orchestrated campaign of scientific racism swept the United States and didn't flag in public energy for 40 long years. Racial suicide was the Red Scare, Fifth Column, and AIDS epidemic of its day all rolled into one. In the long history of manufactured crises, it ranks up there with the Reichstag fire, Pearl Harbor, the Gulf of Tonkin, the gasoline shortage of 1973, the Asian economic miracle, and corporate downsizing as a prime example of modern psychological management of public opinion. The racial suicide theme sounded at exactly the moment public schooling was transforming itself into forced government schooling. The American campaign against, quote, racial suicide enlisted great scientists of the day to produce a library full of books, scientific journal articles, popular magazine pieces, legislation, lectures, and indirect school curricula. It caught the attention of the entire civilized world, including Imperial Germany and Imperial Japan. Both sent official study delegations to America to observe the resourcefulness of this new industrial utopia in purging itself of its original democratic character. It is as if there exists some tacit understanding on the part of mainstream scholarship and journalism to steer clear of the shoals of this period. But even an amateur like myself finds enough to indicate that racial suicide provided a leading motive to justify the radical shift of American society toward well-schooled orthodoxy. What's intriguing in the light of the relative amnesia concerning these connections is the sheer quantity of the damning data. Genetic experimentation, once teased from its hiding holes, is revealed as a master political project of the 20th century, with the United States, Germany, and England its enthusiastic sponsors. Data gathered in school surveys and social experimentation with children have been important sources of grist for this initiative. MIT's Walker got an intellectual boost from activities of the influential American sociologist Edward A. Ross, who explained to the American Academy of Political and Social Science exactly how an unchecked Asiatic immigration would lead to the extinction of the American people. Higher races, he said, will not endure competition from lower ones. After that, even Teddy Roosevelt was issuing marching orders to Anglo-Saxon mothers, asking well-bred ladies to mobilize their loins in an effort to arrest the suicidal decline. "Breed as if the race depended on it," said Roosevelt. Eugenics had openly become national politics for the first time in America, but hardly the last. Harper's Weekly chastised Roosevelt, saying mere exhortation would have no effect as long as immigration continued to reduce the native birth rate by insulting our best breeders. That native is, of course, with tongue in cheek. From 1905 to 1909, at least one major popular magazine article on the subject appeared every single month. Books warned that race suicide would toll the passing of this great Anglo-Teuton people, giving the nation over to Latins, Slavs, or worse, Jews and other Asiatics. Meanwhile, the long-ignored genetic work of monk Gregor Mendel was conveniently rediscovered, adding more fuel to the fires of racial thinking. Here, presumably, a humble man of God showed mathematically that something caused transmission of characteristics from generation to generation, independent of any effect of nurture or education. Horse, dog, and rose breeders had empirically derived these insights 1,000 years before Mendel, but credit passed to science for the, quote, discovery. Into the center of this racial experiment strode the formidable figure of Sir Francis Galton, first cousin of Charles Darwin, in line of descent from Malthus, possessor of incredible intellectual ability and indefatigable energy, a man of great personal wealth, a knight of the realm. Galton preached the improvement of the human breed with evangelical fervor, demanding a policy of biological positivism, which would produce the same genetic dividends that were being reaped by positivism in the hard sciences of chemistry and physics. The eugenics movement, as it was now called, would save us socially by manipulating the best to breed, positive eugenics, and encouraging the worst to die out, negative eugenics. School would have a major role to play in this. Race improvement was in the air, its method compounded out of state action and forced schooling. Galton's inspiration and plenty of American money, much of it Andrew Carnegie's and Mrs. Averill Harriman's, opened the first racial science laboratory in the world in Cold Spring Harbor, Long Island, in 1904, and kept it open for 35 years, until Hitler's invasion of Poland made discretion seem the wiser part of zealotry for the moment at the Carnegie Corporation. In 1939, it was quietly shut down. The last president of the Cold Spring Harbor facility was MIT President Vannevar Bush, often called the father of the atomic bomb. Eugenic thinking injected energy into the exploding, quote, mental hygiene movement, too. Word went out to the recently erected national network of hospitals that it was okay to begin sterilizing mental defectives. The green light came complete with legislative licenses to decide who those defectives were, and freedom from any legal jeopardy. A scholarly book from MIT created intellectual havoc in the year 1899 and long afterwards, lending maximum credibility to the eugenicist agenda. The Races of Europe was written by brilliant economist William Z. Ripley. It armed the racial suicide crowd and its companion group of enthusiasts, the racial science crowd, with information that Europe was divided into three races, easily distinguishable from one another by physical measurements. First, a race of blonde longheads, the Teutons. Second, a central race of stocky roundheads, the Alpines. And third, a southern race of slender, dark longheads, the Mediterraneans. Here, finally, was a way to distinguish reliably among the qualities of old immigration and new. Ripley took the 28-year-old Darwinian concept of reversion and charged it with new energy. Was it possible, Ripley asked, that the promiscuous breeding of Nordic peoples with southern Europeans could doom the New England Anglo-Nordic stock? Incipient race suicide could be dealt with only by legislation. Education should be employed to raise the current immigrant's standard of morality, making him more tolerable to society. That would help. But nothing could be done about reversion. Subspecies of men could not be allowed to couple with 100% American female breeding stock. All the pieces were now in position for full-scale national hysteria to commence, an era of sanctions buttressed by the authority of peerless scientific experts. American society would require harsh discipline after the Prussian fashion in order to meet this challenge. Thanks to men like Ripley, the experts could apply such discipline with an exalted sense of mathematical righteousness. The first requirement would be to force the dangerous classes into schools. Laws were on the books. Time to enforce them. A covert American sterilization program managed by trusted administrators in the brand new hospital network took place during the same years that forced schooling was being brought along. This sterilization initiative occasionally broke silence in highly specialized journals whose reader discretion was taken for granted. Thus, Charles V. Carrington, writing in the Journal of Criminal Law, Criminology, and Political Science in July 1910, reported on two interesting cases of successful involuntary sterilization. One involved a, quote, epileptic masturbator who, after vasectomy, quote, ceased masturbating altogether. The other was a black man, also given to masturbation and general deviltry. After sterilization, he became a, quote, strong, well-developed young Negro, nicely behaved, and not a masturbatory sodomist, close quote, Carrington reported. Surgical intervention as social policy was given its precedence in America long before the Nazi era. Advocates of Yale man Gesell's eugenic violence offensive against the underclasses swung from every point on the scientific compass. William McDougall, the eminent social psychologist, announced himself a champion of Nordic superiority. Ellsworth Huntington, a prominent Yale geographer, wrote, "The character of races showing that only one race had any real moral character." Henry Fairfield Osborne, president and founder of the American Museum of Natural History, gave the address of welcome to the Second International Congress of Eugenics. Osborne's close friend, Lothrop Stoddard, wrote, "The revolt against civilization, menace of the underman," and psychologist James McKean Cattell, a force in the rise of standardized testing, wrote to Galton, quote, "We are following in America your advice and example." The famous humanitarian anthropologist Alfred L. Kroeber remarked acidly to a newsman that anti-eugenic protests came only from the orthodoxly religious, rarely from the enlightened camp of science. So there it was. Keep them all in mind. Kroeber, Gesell, Ripley, McDougall, Huntington, Osborne. Great scientific humanist names whose work underscored how important a role forced schooling was designed to play. Scientific studies had shown conclusively that extending the duration and intensity of schooling caused sharp declines in fertility and sterility in many. Part of school's stealth curriculum would be a steady expansion of its reach throughout the century. Two more examples will drive home this relentlessness of this long scientific campaign against American tradition. J.B.S. Haldane, a distinguished Fabian geneticist from England, issued a lurid warning about what might happen if blonde women bred with human demi-apes like Italians, Jews, and other kinds of retrograde biology. Quote, "A new type of sub-men, abhorred by nature, ugly as no natural product is ugly," close quote, would emerge. The new hypothesis held that the female offspring of such unions would be too repulsive to look upon. In Daedalus, or Science and the Future, Haldane said there were really only four fundamental biological innovations of prehistory. 1. Domestication of animals. 2. Domestication of plants. 3. The use of fungi for the production of alcohol. 4. The invention of frontal copulation, which altered the path of sexual selection, focused the attention of man as a lover upon woman's face and breasts, and changed our idea of beauty from the Steatopygus Hottentot to the modern European, from the Venus of Brassenpui to the Venus of Milo, close quote. All evolution might be in jeopardy if there were no more pretty faces to look at. This was the thesis. Today, there is an aura of the absurd to these assertions, but it would be well to reflect on the institutional world that emerged from the other end of this same forge. For it is the new moral world you and I live in, a fully scientized and organized society managed by the best people, people who prefer to remain out of sight of the hoi polloi, segregated in their own walled villages and other redoubts. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. No discussion of the dreamlike years of overt American scientific racism in schooling would be complete without a nod to the ghost of Madison Grant, who has mysteriously vanished from the pages of some standard biographical references, though they still carry his cousins, Grant the portrait painter and Grant the educator. No matter, I shall tell you about him. If you've ever been to the Bronx Zoo, you've been a guest of Mr. Grant's beneficent imagination, for he was the founder and the founder of its parent, the New York Zoological Society. The Bronx Zoo, its fame and good works inspire worldwide gratitude. Grant's legacy to us, as free libraries were to Carnegie's. Grant was a lifelong bachelor, a childless man. Like many people associated with public schooling on a policy level, Grant came from a patrician family which had graced society from colonial days. No Grant ever held a menial job. Madison Grant was considered a leading scientific naturalist of his time. His monographs on the Rocky Mountain goat, the moose, and the caribou are little classics of their kind still consulted. Men and women related to Grant have been directors of American society since the age of the Mathers. Grant was deeply disgusted by the mixing of European races underway here. He believed the foundation of our national and cultural life lay in racial purity, and backed this opinion with action. It is hardly possible to believe some of this attitude didn't enter into the museum's presentation of data, and even into those hundreds of thousands of school field trips. In Grant's competent hands, the boldness and sweep of old Anglo-Saxon tradition was fused into a systematic worldview then broadcast through books and lectures to the entire planet. His magnum opus appeared in 1916 bearing the epic title, The Passing of the Great Race, with an introduction by Museum of Natural History luminary Henry Fairfield Osborne, a man who wrote one of the texts I used myself as a junior high school student. The Passing of the Great Race warns that the ruling race of the Western world is beginning to wane because of a fatuous belief that environment can alter heredity. The clear connection to the predestination canon of Calvin and the great Norse tradition of implacable fate is unmistakable. Grant's own genealogy came from both these strains in European history. Whatever else he was, Grant was neither dull nor commonplace. Using Darwin and Mendelian genetics to support his argument, Grant said flatly that different races do not blend, that mixing gives us a race reverting to the more ancient and lower type. A cross between any of the three European races and a Jew is a Jew. Grant argued that culture is racially determined. Alpines have always been peasants, Mediterraneans, artists and intellectuals. But the white man par excellence was the Nordic blonde conqueror of the North. Explorers, fighters, rulers, aristocrats, organizers of the world. In early America, the stock was purely Nordic, but now swarming hybrids threatened it with destruction, except in a few zones of racial purity, like Minnesota. Madison Grant felt democracy as a political system violated scientific facts of heredity the same way Christianity did, by favoring the weak. This led inexorably to biological decadence. Even national consciousness might confuse one's rational first loyalty, which had to be race. This was the codex of the Bronx Zoo's founder. 6 years after its publication, The Passing of the Great Race was still in print, and Grant's New York Zoological Society more respectable than ever. Eventually, Margaret Mead was beneficiary of considerable patronage from Grant's Museum of Natural History, as indeed the whole shaky new community of anthropological thought became. Although Mead's work appears to contradict Grant's, by the time the academic world began to push the relativism of Mead, Ruth Benedict, and other interpreters of primitive culture, a double standard had settled on intellectual life in the United States and Europe. For those whose status was secured by birth, theories of inherited quality were available. For the great mass of others, however, the body of theory which paid off in foundation grants, the one driving modern political and economic development, was that the corpus of studies exploring the notion of extreme plasticity in human nature, a pliability grading into shapelessness, if mankind were seen to be clay, radical social action justifying continuous intervention could surely bring utopia within reach while providing expanding opportunities to academics. The academic marketplace eagerly supplied evidence that quality was innate to the powerful and evidence that human nature was empty to the rest of us. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The spring used to classify the U.S. population in an unprecedented and very radical way was World War I. Prior to the war, eugenicists evaluated racial and national groups by comparing numbers of one group or another on, quote, lists of distinction. But they had no way of penetrating the secret inner spaces of consciousness. On the verge of the World War, the new social discipline of psychology, struggling to attain a status of hard science, claimed to be able to change all that. It boasted of a power to go deep into the hidden regions of the brain. The new techno-miracle of the day was the invention of a mysterious intelligence test, an IQ score which allegedly could place secrets of intellectual power at the disposal of managerial science. The just-assembled American Army of World War I was soon subject to mass intelligence measurement under the direction of Robert M. Yerkes, president of the American Psychological Association, an organization recently invented by the Wundtian protege G. Stanley Hall. Results published after the war showed remarkable correlation with similar tests on American school children. While Yerkes was reporting these findings to the National Academy of Sciences, famous psychologist Dr. William McDougall was summarizing the civilian studies for the general public in his book, Is America Safe for Democracy? Latins and Slavs in fair mental competition scored significantly lower than native whites, he said. How then could they be given a vote equal to white men? McDougall claimed that hard data unmistakably revealed that a racial interpretation of history was the correct one. In his book, A Study of American Intelligence, psychologist Carl Brigham concluded in 1923 that, quote, the intellectual superiority of our Nordic group over Alpine, Mediterranean, and Negro groups has been demonstrated, close quote. After 1922, racism was a truth of science. Word spread quickly into every corner of Europe, but particularly in defeated Germany, ancient Teutonic barrier against Slavic incursion. These new truths were enthusiastically discussed. General agreement confirmed Nordic superiority. The popular writer Kenneth Roberts took up the cry. One of America's foremost novelists, he lectured American book dealers from the pages of the specialist journal Bookman that, quote, the Alpine school of fiction, close quote, spread the poison of democracy through the whole culture. School texts were appropriately adjusted. Roberts identified himself, as you may have already guessed, as 100% Nordic. Now intelligence tests were huckstered in school district after school district. Fortunes accrued to well-placed pedagogical leaders and their political allies. Every child would now be given a magical number, ranking it scientifically in the great race of life. School grades might vary according to the whim of teachers, but IQ scores were unvarying, an emotionless badge of biological honor or shame, marking innate, almost unchanging ability. Millions of tests administered annually to primary and secondary school students would prove the value rank of the American peoples. Mental ages were dutifully entered on permanent record cards with as much assurance as Horace Mann, Barnes Sears, William Torrey Harris, John Dewey, and G. Stanley Hall had accepted skull maps drawn by their favorite phrenologists. Every day, science seemed to make it clearer and clearer that forcing everyone to fit the Anglo-Saxon mold was indeed doing humanity a mighty favor. If children couldn't be biologically Anglo-Nordic, they could be so acculturated, at least partly that way, through regular drill. After all, hadn't psychology proven how malleable human nature was? Henry Fairfield Osborne stepped forward from his duties at the American Museum of Natural History to announce portentously that Christopher Columbus, always a choking point as a Latin for America's cultural leadership, was actually Nordic. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. By the first year of World War I, American political leadership was ferreting out disloyalty and enforcing scientific conformity. Any number of private and secret societies appeared to forward this cause. The Anti-Yellow Dog League was one of these, composed of schoolboys above the age of 10, who searched out disloyalty each day from one of its 1,000 branches nationwide, barking like German shepherds when a disloyal yellow dog, otherwise someone looking like you or me, was flushed from cover and branded. Schools enthusiastically cooperated in dog hunts, as they were called. The U.S. Justice Department secretly empowered private associations as volunteer spy hunters. One, the American Protective League, APL, earned semi-official status in the national surveillance game, in time growing to enormous size. Founded by a Chicago advertising man, the APL had 1,200 units functioning across America, all staffed by business and professional people. It was a genuine secret society replete with oaths and rituals. Membership gave every operative the authority to be a national policeman. The first location placed under surveillance in every neighborhood was the local public school. Assignments were given by the old Federal Bureau of Investigation and by the War Department's Intelligence Division to report seditious and disloyal conversation. From the authorized history of the APL comes this specimen case, quote, Powers County, Colorado, investigated 50 cases of mouth-to-mouth propaganda, a notable cause being that of a German Lutheran minister who refused to answer the questions as to which side he wished to win the war. He asked for time. The next day he declared very promptly that he wanted the United States to win. He was instructed to prove this by preaching and praying in private as well as in public, which he agreed to do. Close quote. The APL checked up on people who failed to buy Liberty Bonds. It spotted violators of food and gasoline regulations, rounded up draft evaders in New York, disrupted socialist meetings in Cleveland, broke strikes, threatened union men with immediate induction into the army. The Attorney General of the United States reported to Congress, "It is safe to say never in history has this country been so thoroughly policed." Nor, he might have added, "the training of the young so well regulated." And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. Prior to 1860, Americans didn't demand a high level of national solidarity. A loose sort of catch-as-catch-can unity satisfied the nation in spite of the existence even of those patriotic special interest groups like Know-Nothings. Neither by geography, culture, common experience, or preference was the United States naturally a single country, although it did possess a common language. But conformity had been ordered by corporate and banking interests from the Northeast, so one country it would become. Stupendous profits accrued to these interests from the Civil War, and its great lesson of national regimentation into squads, platoons, brigades, companies, regiments, and army corps was not lost on the winners. Warfare, by nature, forces men to wear value ranks openly for all to see, forces everyone to subordinate themselves to higher ranks, and higher ranks to subordinate themselves to invisible orders. War conditions men to rule and be ruled. Modern war creates a society far different in type and scale from the ragged and bizarre individuality which emerged out of the American Revolution. With everyone dressing alike, eating alike, and doing everything else alike, maximum profit can be derived from the use of mass production machinery in an ideal environment where the goods of production are swiftly wasted and military consumers are literally forbidden the right to refuse to consume. A soldier must wear his uniform, eat his food, fire his rifle. To guarantee customers through psychological drills is the very essence of the corporate world about to come into being. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. John Taylor Gatto was an award-winning teacher in the New York City schools. After 3 decades, he quit the profession and has devoted his life to understanding the root causes of why our educational system does not develop the intellect, but instead tends to produce ignorant and easily manipulated people. You can download all of his book online and find out about his work as one of the nation's foremost advocates of self-directed education and homeschooling, which he calls unschooling, at johntaylorgatto.com. That's johntaylorgatto.com. And you can download an MP3 or podcast of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
The rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black bass. Yes, they'll catch me napping one day and they'll kill me, and then I'll be gone, but it won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled, sir, by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. And they'll take the money and spread it out equal, just like in the Bible and the prophets suggest. But the men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will cut down like an unwelcome guest.